Hey, this is Monroe, and with me is Bhavna.
Hey.
We're both participants of the Alter U internship by Portland State University. Welcome to our podcast, Sand Piles, the Master of DDoS. In this podcast, we hope to share our research on combating a cyber attack called DDoS by using mathematical modeling tool, the Abelian Sand Pile model.
For this project, we had Dr. Art Duvall of UTEP work with us, who's here for an interview with us. And we're also going to be interviewing Saket, who's starting as a freshman at University of California, Berkeley.
If I'm attacked by some cyber attack, whatever it may be, how am I supposed to know when I've been attacked?
Yeah, so if you're especially someone who just uses the web browser to do basic things like browsing Netflix or emailing or just doing some online shopping, a cyber attack may seem abstract without a tangible attacker.
So let's take a DDoS attack, for example, which DDoS stands for distributed denial of service. When something is DDoSed, there's an unavailable error because your computer cannot access the server to get the information.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you see when you try to access a website, but you end up looking at service unavailable error. And so this error can be due to an unexpected overloading, but when it is due to a DDoS attack, it's much more serious, and the server that you're trying to reach out to is experiencing this attack.
And the disruptions that internet users face due to a DDoS attack is what we are trying to minimize.
We would like to welcome Saket, who is a rising CS freshman at University of California, Berkeley. He is co-founder of Project Morph, an organization dedicated to taking a stance against domestic violence.
He has interned as a software engineer at the educational management tech company, KudosWall.
I know a little bit about DDoS, but what exactly are you guys looking into about it?
We're looking into a method to mitigate DDoS attacks called blackholing. We're looking into blackholing because it is a common method that is easy to implement and cheap, so many nonprofit and governmental organizations can use our resources to optimize their use of blackholing as a method of mitigation.
What is blackholing?
It is when one server is sacrificed in order to allow all the other servers to stabilize so that the network can go back online. All the data that enters the black hole gets deleted. And the black hole cannot tell the difference between the good data and the bad data, or malicious.
Why would you want to do this? It seems like a bad idea, because you're just throwing information away.
Well, sometimes it's the only way to approach the issue. It doesn't take too fancy of tactics. It's relatively easy to implement, and it works well enough. At the end of the day, we want our network to go back online and also save the organization the loss of clients.
So what server is usually the best to be blackholed?
Well, we've been solely looking at backbone networks, so usually the one that is attacked is the best one to be blackholed. However, that's not always the case because it can be a bit more complicated.
So what is a backbone network and why is it so important?
So back in the day, we used to have something called the internet backbone, and that's not really the case anymore because we don't have one large network that makes up the core of the internet. We have lots of subnetworks, and we call these backbone networks because they make up the internet as we know it today. And these are usually the internet service providers we know, like AT&T or Cogent Communications or networks like that. And if they are attacked, there's a lot at loss because we have a lot of people using their services.
If all of the backbone networks were attacked, then all of the subnetworks would crash. But this would take a massive attack to accomplish, and many precautions have been put in place so that this doesn't happen. However, if it did, it would be catastrophic to the internet. One more thing, backbone networks tend to be much simpler since they're kind of a bird's eye view. So it is generally much easier to make models of the backbone network. Our problem that we want to tackle is minimizing the amount of data that ends up in the black hole. We want to approach this issue because less data that gets deleted within the network is better for the network in total and better for the customers. The problem that we're looking at is how to optimize A, which server you choose to be the black hole, and B, how to minimize the amount that goes into said server. We do this because we want the most amount of data and therefore customers to be content.
To approach this optimization problem, we're going to be using a mathematical model, which is the abelian sandpile model. And we have our faculty mentor, Dr. Art DeVal, here to help us discuss that. Welcome, Art.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Art.
So my name is Art DeVal. I'm a professor of mathematical sciences at the University of Texas at El Paso, and I've been here since 1991. My research is in algebraic and topological combinatorics, which means that I count things, that's the combinatorics part, and the topological part is that the things that I count are somehow topological or geometric in nature. One of the things that I've spent a lot of time looking at in the past several years is about what I'll call spanning trees of higher dimensional complexes. So if you take the networks, like in the problem that you're looking at, a spanning tree is a collection of edges or connections that connect all the cities, but do it with the fewest edges possible. And so one of the things that we've been doing is looking at how to make that work in higher dimensions. In addition to my mathematical research, I've been involved in educational issues for about 20 years, especially around issues of teacher preparation and the surprisingly deep mathematics that underlies the mathematics that goes on in the K-12 schools. About a year ago, I stepped down from serving as a contributing editor to the American Mathematical Society blog on teaching and learning mathematics, which I had done for 5 years.
So using his experience as our faculty mentor, Art has guided us through using a mathematical model for our black holing problem. So Art, what advice do you have about using mathematical modeling to analyze real world scenarios?
Sure. You know, one thing that's really great that I enjoy about working with the two of you is that you already had an idea of what you wanted to solve. And I think that always makes it better if people come in with an idea of what it is that they want to do and that they're working on something that they're interested in. That certainly always worked for me. And I have to say that actually I haven't had to say too much to you because you both already have so many good ideas. But I think one thing that I was able to contribute is the idea that you would see some patterns in a matrix or something like that. I was able to say, well, you know, how does that row of the matrix correspond to a particular vertex of the graph? So, you know, the idea about looking at your data or whatever and then go back to the mathematical model. Earlier in my career, when I wanted to work on applications, I'd look for my math in their problems. I'd go talk to someone about their problems, like, how can I turn this into an interesting combinatorics problem? And that never worked, ever. But what works better is that now when I talk to people about applications, I say, tell me about your problem. And then I see if there's anything that I know that can be helpful. And that's been the most useful thing in terms of making myself useful as a mathematician to people who have real problems.
The mathematical model we used is called the abelian sandpile model. How would you briefly explain the abelian sandpile model without any real mathematical notation?
Okay, sure. So let me start with a particular model. Imagine you have a big grid. It could be a square grid, it could be a hexagon grid, it could be any sort of grid. And so what does that mean? That's a bunch of vertices, like cities in your network, and edges that connect the pairs of vertices. And so on this grid, we're going to put grains of sand, integer numbers of grains of sand, on the vertices, and we call such an arrangement like that. It's officially a configuration. And what we're going to do is we start with some configuration, then we're going to add a grain of sand one at a time to a particular spot, a particular vertex. And then if any vertex has too much sand, it's going to topple to its neighbors. And what that means is if the number of grains of sand is at least the number of neighbors, then that vertex will send one grain of sand to each of its neighbors. And so that's all well and good, but then as the first vertex sends sand to its neighbors, those neighbors might now suddenly have too much sand and they will also topple. And this just keeps going until it stabilizes, until no vertex has too much sand. The abelian in the abelian sand pile model is because you might wonder, well, if I have two different vertices that both have enough sand to topple, which one should I do first? Abelian is a word we use in math to mean that the order of things doesn't matter, and that's what's going on here. The order in which you topple the vertices doesn't matter. And I said to imagine this grid, but actually you can do this on any graph or network, just like the networks that you're looking at. And so in general, this is just any collection of vertices, and they're all connected by edges any way you like. You don't even have to be able to draw them in a plane. There's two interesting things I want to say about the abelian sand pile model. One is it was initially introduced as an example of something called self-organizing criticality. The self-organizing part is about how each vertex just has its one little local rule, and we don't have to tune the parameters or anything. It just goes off on its own. The criticality is a little harder to explain, but it's an interesting phenomenon, and it's related to the power law we sometimes see in large networks. The other thing I wanted to mention, just because it's near and dear to my heart, is I mentioned about these spanning trees, and the number of spanning trees is actually the number of certain configurations, but I won't go into the details about that.
Thank you. And so we've been taking data from a data set called the Internet Topology Zoo, and we take the backbone network and think of that network as an abelian sand pile model. And just like Art said, we imagine that each server is a platform and that every time a server gets a request, a sand grain is added. And you just keep adding sand grains and you get a sand pile. However, at one point, when you add too many sand grains, the sand pile will topple and send extra grains to the neighboring servers. That is when they become overloaded.
And so a network with multiple servers can be thought about as having different sand piles of different sizes. And say the network is at a state where it cannot accept any more sand grains without any of its sand piles toppling. Then you say that the network is running at a maximum capacity. During a DDoS attack, there is an overwhelming amount of malicious traffic. We get an undesired influx in sand grains that threaten the stability of our network. Because the legitimate sand grains and the malicious sand grains are indistinguishable, the excess sand grains do not have anywhere to go. So what we want to do is we want to find the best server to black hole so that it welcomes any amount of excess data and deletes it. So we're going to be calling that server a sink. Art, sink is a term that we are borrowing from the abelian sand pile model. Could you tell us about the role of a sink in a general sand pile graph?
Sure. It's pretty much like what you were saying, that if we have too much sand in the model, then it would actually never stabilize. You would just keep toppling and toppling and toppling, and we'd never hit stability ever. So the way around this is we pick one vertex and we call it the sink. And then that vertex behaves differently than all the other vertices. Any grains of sand that land in that vertex, they simply disappear. And that sink vertex, it's not allowed to topple because, well, it never piles up. And so it's a remarkable thing that if you have even just that one sink vertex, I guess we have to assume a few basic things about the graph. If we have just that one sink vertex, then the sand pile model will always stabilize. And if you think about really big models, for instance, I remember I started with talking about, you know, say a large grid, what you can do is just put a single sink vertex and attach it to all the vertices at the edge of that grid. And then that acts as if there's a giant, I don't know, circular trough around the edge of your graph. And so when things get far enough away from the center, they just disappear. And so that's what the sink does. And I think it's really appropriate for your model.
What we want from our sink is to have the least number of sand grains in it as possible. On top of considering how many grains within the network end up in the sink, also consider how many customers are denied service for the duration that the network is down. Our model can also consider length of the DDoS attack as a parameter while suggesting the right server to enable as the sink. Our model is quite simplistic and built on quite a few assumptions. How can a toy model like this be helpful for real-world networks, though, Art?
Oh, that's a great question. And we use toy models in mathematics all the time. In fact, you can even think of the abelian sandpile model itself. It is really a very simple model. I'm sure real sand doesn't say how tall am I, and now I'm going to topple to my neighbors. And yet, this abelian sandpile model yields very rich results that we haven't even begun to touch here. Anyway, about toy models in general, well, one thing is you have to start somewhere, right? You've got to start building your model from something. And it's really hard to build a complicated model without testing it at some smaller version of itself first. But actually, I don't want to think about smaller version. I want to think about simpler version, a less detailed model. In this case, it might be even just also less complicated computer code. Any complicated code that I've ever written, I don't just write it from top to bottom and it works from the beginning. No, you start with, let's make it work just for the easiest cases or with the fewest number of parameters or whatever. And what's interesting is that in many situations, even with these simpler models, you can already see interesting things. And so it's worthwhile not just to build it and test, okay, great, let's move on, but build it and test and see, hey, what's going on in this case? What interesting patterns do we see? And so first off, sometimes that's just easier to deal with while you build up your theory. But also sometimes when you spot these interesting things, even in the simple cases, you can use that to design the next level up. Like you notice that this was interesting. Hey, maybe in the next iteration of the model, we should really pay close attention to this particular feature that we saw in the simpler model and try to push it out that way. And then, of course, once you start simple, you can continue to build it up step by step by step. But the longest journey begins with a single step, and that's what the toy models are.
Art, thank you for answering our questions and just talking about our experience of like working together on this project.
Sure. It was great to talk to you. I really enjoyed working with you this summer. Thanks a lot.
All right, Saket, what's your opinion on the idea of applying this mathematical computational model to the idea of these networks?
I've never thought of using abstract math concepts to describe these networks, but I think it's a good way to apply these ideas. I'd like to play around with this interface and see what it could do.
Do you think that this draws analogous to the real world?
I'm not sure if analogous is the best word to describe it, but I definitely think that this is applicable because there's been a large number of DDoS attacks this year as a result of more people using internet services due to the pandemic. I think this is a great way to look at these ideas.
What simplifications are being made that we may have overlooked?
I think maybe you could have looked at other factors of network security rather than simply network structural features. I'd also like to see you consider things other than internet backbone networks.
All right, Saket, thanks for being on this podcast with us.
No problem.
Thank you. So for our model, we used Sage to build it because Sage is built on top of Python and is accessible through Jupyter Notebook. It also has the abelian sandpile model built in, and it has all the data structures that Python comes with. And best of all, it's free.
As part of the model, we used a lot of different Python packages. First, we used the network X to convert our graph files. We also used NumPy, which is for matrices. We also used SciPy and a whole bunch of other packages that can all still be used for Sage. And we got our graphs that we mentioned earlier from a website called the Internet Topology Zoo, which is a large data set of like different backbone network graphs all over the world. Okay, so what can our model actually do? Our model can take in basically any network and analyze it. So when you analyze it, what we can see is which servers can be most susceptible to attacks and which servers can actually be good black holes for a server that's attacked.
it can create a heat map from these matrices. These heat maps give a visualization where you can match up the sync server with the attacked server. What our model cannot do, though, is a handful of things. Currently, but hopefully soon, it cannot tell you how to prematurely mitigate the DDoS attack by either adding servers or connections between servers.
It also cannot quickly compute large networks because the algorithm has to go through each server and consider the source of attack, and it also has to go through the same list of servers and consider them as a potential sink. So this algorithm grows at a quadratic rate. And our model is also still quite simplistic despite all the parts that we're factoring in.
So how do we hope to expand upon and improve our model? One thing that we're trying to focus on is trying to optimize the algorithm so that the code runs quickly, hopefully quickly as in linear growth instead of quadratic. We plan to do this by deriving a formula for the matrix that does not need the stabilization algorithm.
Currently, what the model can do is provide mitigation suggestions, but hopefully we'll be able to determine how to make the network safer in the future to prepare for a DDoS attack.
And lastly, we hope to add more variables so that the model will be closer to reality, such as the network might not be at full capacity initially, or more servers can be attacked simultaneously. A question that arises is who can benefit from this? Really anyone who uses the internet. If we have to be more specific, those who work within internet nonprofit working in security, as well as higher education institutes who have their own network. We're hoping that our algorithm, our model, can address attacks that might happen on smaller scale networks, such as the ones that occur on a university campus's network, because in general, they don't have as good of resources to address the issues. We also hope that this can help the fast-growing movement of municipal broadbands, where municipal broadbands are local government-run internet service providers. And again, with small teams, it can be hard to identify where they're susceptible. So this tool could be used freely by them.
So how could this benefit someone who is not managing a network and is worried about their network security? This could actually benefit the user too, because if you use the internet, you might have run into problems before, and this could help your experience with using the internet be more convenient. Especially, this can benefit the listener if we can distribute this model to nonprofits and municipal broadbands or other local area networks that are in your area.
How will this benefit people? Like Bhavna said, cybersecurity is important for use of the internet. If we don't have security, then the internet could go into chaos, especially on those smaller networks where only a handful of people could control the entire network. In the future, you should be able to get access to this code on our GitHubs, which could be found on my website or by emailing either one of us. My website will be included in the info.
Finally, we would like to acknowledge the people who will help us along the way.
Thank you, Art Duval, for mentoring us throughout the summer.
Thank you, Salkis, for joining us on this podcast. And thank you, Dave Perkinson, for introducing us to Sandpiles.
And thank you to Christoph and Mackenzie for making the AltRU possible.
And also just thank you to everyone at PSU and in the AltRU who helped us just make it through the AltRU and have all the resources we need.
And we thank you, the listeners, for sitting and listening to what we had to say about our project.
What if they were walking?